Okay, and let me say before we start that I watched Rabbi Weider, his last of his five classes, and I think that our Monday night classes inspired that because I kept quoting him, and I think that's when I think so. That's when Rabbi Kelman said we should have him, and I have to say it's a tour de force what he did, five classes. There's nothing like it online, that's for sure.
And
About
that's, as I told him after already the first class, I said, I'm never laning again because you see the expertise that be a really excellent Balkori. Wow, what you got to know. So,
I think at least that we inspired it here. If we didn't, but I
right.
think we did. So that's great. Okay, everyone. Just a couple things. So we got great stuff as always. I just want to correct something. I spelled Meshulam Roth. It was the he was Rabbi in Chernovitz. It was in Lvov that he had to withdraw if he his Mizrahi involvement if he wanted it. I mentioned Ibn Tibbon. Here's a famous guide for the Perplexus translation. And I said that some words he invented. If you look in the back, it's he has Perush Mehamilot Zarot. And just to give you a couple words that Ibn Tibbon invented, you might be surprised. Siur, as meaning like imagination, but also Merkaz. We all know the word Merkaz, center. That's Ibn Tibbon. We have the root, Resh Chav Zayin. And that's one of the words that he invented. So you can check that out. Let me put this over here. Okay, someone, I think Shmuel is his name, wrote me an email. We have lots of people listening in the old classes, and he wants to know, we those who were with us in the early classes, we did a lot on TikTok and all sorts of interesting stuff. At least I think it's interesting. I think it's interesting. I know Susanna thinks it's interesting looking at it, but he wants to know, first of all, well, what is this? Isn't this just for the Sfardim and do Ashkenazim really care? And he says, does God really care? And I said, well, first of all, it's nothing to do with God caring. God knows what we're doing, but if you're supposed to pronounce it properly. If I tell you that President Biden, you know who I'm referring to, but I'm mispronouncing his name. But then he said, but do he's been to yeshiva. Do any Ashkenazim really care about this anymore? And the truth is, he's probably right. You mostly find this in the Sephardic world, but not exclusively. I mean, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky felt it important, but if you look historically, you have Rav Yaakov Emden, Rav Shabtai Sofer, and you have the Gra, the Vilna Gaon. So of course this has been important in the Ashkenazic world. And I want to show you people something now, which I didn't share with him, but I just want to call your attention to it. There's a book called Aliyos Eliyahu, which was written about, I think it was published, in the 1850s by Yehoshua HaShelev. It's a hagiography of the Gra, the Vilna Gaon. And this is the new edition. It's on page 96. I want you to look in the note here, note 75. It says as follows, that the Av Beis Din, the rabbi of the city of Kedan in Lithuania, told me that when the Vilna Gaon was in his youth, he came to Kedan and he was there making sure that the children will learn in the Talmud Torah, and especially that they learn the difference between Mila'el and Mila'ra, that what we spoke about, that is words that the syllable is the penultimate, the second to the end, versus the end, so that they can pronounce it properly. And then he said as follows, and let's see if anyone can figure out what this means, and type it in the chat if you don't know. Uveschok amar, and jokingly the Gra said, "Ki lefitzit tusam lo amru devar emes me'olam." The Gra says, based upon what how the kids sound, "Lo amru devar emet me'olam." Lo amru devar emes me'olam. What does he mean? Anyone know when he says that the children lo amru devar emet me'olam? What the Gra means here? Anyone have an idea? If not, I'll explain it to you what he means. It's the Vilna Gaon's joking. Lo, he says about these children, lo amru dvar emes leolam. Dvar emet. It's a big, oh, let me see here. Got to see the chat here. No one got it. Okay, what he means is as follows. Oh, so one more person sent it in. Let's see. No. What it means is as follows. they were pronouncing the word MS, but it's supposed to be pronounced MS, or in Sephardic, Emet, but MS. So when it says, Lo Amru Devar MS Le'olam, they never spoke truth. He's playing on that expression that appears in Tanakh, Devar MS, because they never said MS. They only said MS. So that was the film. And remember, Jesus said before that they have to learn the difference between Mila'el and Mila'ra. And he joked and said, until now, they've never said Devar MS or Devar MS. I don't know how he pronounced it in their life, because they would say MS. They would say, they would always get the words wrong. So that's the first thing I want to show you. Take that, was it Shmuel or Shlomo to, we'll turn that off to your Ashkenazic Rosh Yeshivas. Incidentally, I found also the Ben Ish Chai says the same. We spoke about the Gra, and I'm going to bring you some stuff about the Gra also in a future class. But the Ben Ish Chai also uses the word I found, Hazot, Laila Hazot. He has a whole thing about this. And so it's not just the Gra. Okay, someone emailed me about the dancing, the young Israel dancing. So I don't want to get too much into this, but let me show you something else. I just Googled it, and what comes up from 1934, October, an article from the JTA, the Young Israel Bronx Gardens was having their annual dance. But then, and of course we all know this is common, this is popular, but then as I'm Googling, looking around, I come across an article by the indefatigable Zev Elif. A touchy subject, a short history of the rise and fall of Orthodox social dancing. So you can read all you want on it. But he pointed out something I didn't know, which is fascinating. If you recall, we, let me get rid of this. We spoke about the Masmit, which is the Yeshiva College yearbook. So here we have the Masmit from 1936. And if you look in it, you see all sorts of great stuff. Here, by the way, is the tennis team at Yeshiva College in 1936. If you look at the pictures, you see the guys didn't wear yarmulkes when they were outside. It's sort of like this German Yeki idea that they only have to wear it inside, because there's plenty of pictures where they don't have it. And there's a picture of Mo Feuerstein, for those people from Boston who I mentioned before. He was in that graduating class. But what Zev Elif called attention to is a couple of pages before on this, on Yeshiva College yearbook, talks about how the junior year, take a look at this, the junior class, last year the class had its first social affair, a dance at the Peter Stuyvesant Hotel. What I can assure you of, without any fear of being contradicting, is the Yeshiva College now is not having dances, they're not putting in the yearbook, and it never would be allowed. But in 1936, there you go. Thank you, Zev Elif, for taking us down memory lane. One more thing I want to share with you guys. I was reading this book. Just came out, because we're talking a lot about today, about Rav Mazuz in the next few weeks. Kovetz Ma'amarim, two volumes of articles, all sorts of great stuff. And on volume, it's in volume one, page 386. He says, he gets back to the idea of the Rambam that we were speaking about against anthropomorphisms. And he quotes from a book by one of the most strange and interesting people we've had. He's a, I've got to show you this picture. So, some of you will know this person. Here he is. You ever heard of Raphael Halperin? Raphael Halperin was a rabbi. He grew up, he was very close to the Chazon Ish. He even wrote a book about the Chazon Ish and his relationship. But he became a wrestler, like a fake wrestler. You can see, here's a picture of him. You see, in his, he used to wear a Star of David. You can even see a video of him. Let's see, hold on a second. Of him wrestling. He was a frum guy. Here he is, Raphael Halperin. And again, after he retired from wrestling, he had a couple of businesses, and he wrote a number of svarim, including a sefer on a very, like, three volumes, I think, on Rashi, because he was descended from Rashi, everything you want about Rashi, and he wrote all sorts of good stuff. So you can look him up later. Well, before we go further, I want to show you. This is, I'll get back to him in a second after I do Rafael Halpern. So he wrote a Peirush on Chumash. And he wrote a Peirush, and people who are older probably remember Rafael Halpern. He gave a lot of pride. He was Mr. Israel, the wrestling rabbi, all these sorts of things. But he wrote a Peirush called Diyukim BaTorah. And in volume 1, page 26, he writes that he speaks about the Kedas Yitzchak. It says there's a midrash that the angels, their tears fell into the eyes of Yitzchak. So he asked the question, how is that possible? Angels don't have tears. Do angels have tears? And Rabbi Mazuz, in his comment and his article, says about this, he calls him a Chacham Halpern with Zal, but then he says to him, I don't get the question. And if angels had tears, they still would be falling in Yitzhak's eyes. Aren't the angels far up? And he goes off. He goes, how would the tears have come from all the way up in heaven? And then he says, if Halpern, Rabbi Halpern, would actually study Lomed Umarich and really understand and respect the Rambam, he wouldn't have any of these problems, because he'd understand that all these things about, these are all Mashal Umaritza, that the sages are not speaking literally when they say that the angels have tears or the tears fall in. You wouldn't have these questions. He says, if you learn a little Rambam, you know that all these anthropomorphisms that don't just refer to God, they refer to the angels. You don't ask questions like this because you miss the whole point. And that's what he says about Halpern. You know, there's another from an Orthodox family strong man. Anyone ever hear of this guy? Zisha Breitbart? He was known as the strongest man in the world. He comes from an Orthodox family. They even made a movie about him, Invincible, in 2001. You can read all about him in many places on YIVO. I'm going to show you something else now. You know where he was buried? And here's his tombstone. I don't know if you can see it that well. He was buried in the Adas Yisrael Cemetery in Berlin. I've been going to Berlin before COVID all the time since 1990. The first time I was there in 1990, when it was still East Germany. I even knocked down a piece of the wall, which if I was home, I'd show you. But he's from the Adas community, the Orthodox, Israel Hildesheimer, W.C. Hoffman. In fact, in his cemetery, W.C. Hoffman's buried, Avraham Eliel Kaplan's buried. And I don't know if you can read it. It says, Harbe Kavod Imo, Bigvura Tov, oh no. And, you know, he had all this strength. So that's Zisha Breitbart, probably Andrew Breitbart from Breitbart News. He was adopted. He wasn't Jewish, although he's adopted by Jewish parents. Maybe they converted him. Never heard they converted from Orthodox, but maybe he's descended. The last thing I want to show you before we begin, because I forgot to mention, is about the dancing, is this is Rabbi Solomon Maimon, who was a rabbi in Seattle. He just died like last year at, I think, age 100. He's the first Sephardic Musmach, as far as I know, from Yeshiva College, going back to the early 40s, I believe. And he gave all his sons, you know, Haredi type education, didn't even send them to YU, to Yeshiva, to MTA, sent them to the Haredi schools. But he gave an interview shortly before he died, The Secret to a Successful Sephardic Community. And he says as follows, and he said it, he didn't just do it, he actually spoke about it. I'll just read it to you. Members of Seattle's Sephardic community occasionally reflect on a time when synagogues held dances for the youth, something taboo today. Rabbi Maimon wasn't sure that co-ed programming was right, but he knew it was what he had to do to get the kids coming back. He offered a story about a Sukkot event where he ordered the youth to go to a dance in the social hall. I'm going to lock it and nobody gets out until they have a date, he recalled. That's what happened. They came for Sukkot, they got a date, they had a dance afterwards, and we served them good stuff. It's a powerful example of the rabbi meeting the community where it was and seeking a creative solution to the never-ending problem of Jewish dating. On Yom Kippur, I repented, he said. I told God, I'm wrong, but you put me in charge here, and I say, I have to do wrong to get right. it's going to bring them to marry each other. And that's what they did. So listen, I'm not the post taker or anything, but it's easy to sit where we are in a very different world and look at things. But that's what he did. Incidentally, some have, again, back to Zisha Breitbart, I say I wrote something down. He came in 1923 on an American tour, and he was called Superman of the Ages. And some think that he inspired the Jewish people who created Superman. He inspired him. Okay, everyone, let us now pick up. We are in the Sefer Siman Kufla Mechet, 138, page 293. And I need to tell you a little, give you a little background to what we're doing now, because the title of the letter is, well, first of all, it's Redifat Nuat Yachad, the persecution of the Yachad movement, and then Idiyukim B'tzitu P'sukim Adei Rishonim, Rishonim who quote biblical verses inaccurately. But first, what is Yachad? Yachad, Rav Avadya Yosef passes away in 2013, and shortly after that, about a little more than a year, at the beginning of 2015, there's new elections for the Israeli Knesset. Aryeh Deri, who was corrupt, probably still is corrupt, he went to jail. When he went to jail, Eli Yishai, he was really a simple person. He's not a Talmid Chacham, he's not a rabbi like Deri in the army, but a very honest, low-key sort of person. He ran Shas with Rav Avadya, and there never was a hint of scandal with him. I mean, Shas has had a problem. They've had a lot of people serving time. but when Aryeh Deri gets out, whatever it is, Rav Avadya was convinced that he did his time, okay, to allow him back in to run the show. And he was then exiled, as it were, Eli Yishai, because he couldn't work with Aryeh Deri. So when the Knesset elections were going to be in 2015, Yishai came up with an idea, a plan, that he would start a new party. The question was, who's who's carrying on the message of Rav Avadya Yosef? Is it the Shas party, which is now basically run by Rav Shalom Cohen and Rav David Yosef, and which really became completely Haredi, they thought. As I mentioned before, Rav Shalom Cohen said all sorts of crazy things. He called the people wear kippah strugas as a malek. He referred to, he said, we don't need an army. All we need is tefillah. I mean, all sorts of unbelievable stuff. Well, Eli Yishai wants to be back in Knesset. So he comes up with the idea that he's going to create a coalition of people, Sfardim, who are fed up with Shas because it doesn't represent them. Obviously, Shas and Sfardim support the army, things like that. And also the right-wing religious Zionists, the what we call the Chardalim. And he means both sides of the Chardalim, the Rav Aviner types, who are the Mamachti, and also Rav Dov Lior types, who are, I guess we don't call them Mamachti, but all the Chardalim. And he thought that this could be a nice winning coalition. The problem was that not all the Chardalim went along. Some went with another party. But for a while, it looked like this would be a very powerful party, and they would get in. And everyone was building up Rav Mazuz as the next Maran. In fact, they made videos, and there was all sorts of discussions because there was no real charismatic person in Shas. The question was, though, would the fact that this is Rav Avadya Yosef's party, even if he's not here anymore, would there still be the nostalgia and the loyalty? Because the only reason the Shas party got so many people is because traditional Sfardim, who are not really Orthodox, the way we think of it, they voted for him. So let me just show you some of the things that came out. It was a very dirty election. The Shas party does all sorts of dirty tricks. We don't need to get involved with them in a minute. But let me just show you, just to give you an example of how they portrayed... So here is here's one of the movies. They made three to two like movies and their videos. And the idea was to portray Rav Mazuz and therefore obviously the Yachad party as the true successor to the Shas party. It's like today, Agudas Yisrael in Israel, they say Yadus HaTorah, or Degel HaTorah, that's the true, before there was a joined, that Degel HaTorah, that's the true successor to the Agudas Yisrael, because the Agudas Yisrael split. So here I'll just play for you, for just to get a sense of how they were trying to, like a cult of personality, I guess you could say, rose up around Rav Mazuz, and they were going to use him. Because what happened was that Eli Yishai, he went to Rabbi Mazuz. He's Tunisian himself, that Rav Mazuz would be the leader, and they convinced Rav Mazuz to leave the Beis Medrash. Every day he was going, speaking at different places. It's a bracha that the Yachad party never passed. They got 123,000 votes. If 10,000 more, they would have been in the Knesset. But it's really a bracha, because we don't want the Gedolim, I think, being involved in politics every day. They should be spending their time learning Torah and giving shurim and writing. But they came close. It showed, I guess, the weakness of the Chardalim, that they couldn't pull through. But here, for example, here's one of the videos. So you see, it's obvious, and it's a whole video, you can watch it. They came up with another video also. Actually, that's just a song, not a video. And then there was a third one. Who has three songs written about them? I don't know of any songs that Rav Ovadia even has. But the Tunisians are very attached to Rabbi Mazuz, and... So this is another song that came up. This was after the election, but I like the song. So if you want later, you can listen to some of the music. But it became, as I said, very dirty, the election. And this was when, during the election, video came out of Rav Ovadia Yosef speaking to his people about how the stupidity of Aryeh Deri really knocking him. But we don't know who released that. Obviously, someone from the family. But it became, as I said, quite a dirty election. And Yitzhak Yosef, the Rishon LeZion, who in my book, there's letters from him, he really came out very strongly against Rabbi Mazuz. Sephardic society was split and remains split. There's two, circles in the Sephardic world. You have Rabbi Mazuz, the leader of one, with Rav Amar, Shlomo Amar, and many other rabbis. And then you have Rav Shalom Cohen, Rav Yitzhak Yosef, Rav David Yosef on the other side. And really, the Sephardic community is split. The Yachad party, its whole point was Yachad, that we're all together. They took out ads with a kippah struga and a black kippah. And Rav Mazuz said that Shas, the Shas party, should stand for Shin, black, shachar, kippah, and also kippah sruga, samech. So they tried to have this unity. But I want to play you now just for a minute. If you understand Hebrew, you'll hear what Rav Yitzhak Yosef says about Rabbi Mazuz. And you get a sense of how bitter this has become and remains really to this day. And I'll translate afterwards.
מרן השאיר מורשת אחריו, ויש לי אלו בבני ברק שרוצים לעקוב את המורשת של הרב, ומחברים ספרים, עלומים ועצמות, כל מיני ירחונים מוצאים כל חודש, וכל זה לא נועד אלא לגדר את שמם ולהוריד את הפסקים של מרן. זה המצב היום, יש מלחמה כזו, שחס ושלום להשכיח את תורתו של מרן. היה אחד שאמר בקול חי, זה רדיו אחד, סיפרו לי שהוא אמר, 500 שנה לא קם כמו בשם בבני ברק, לא רוצה. 500 שנה לא קם כמו, מה 500 שנה? מרן לא היה, גדול הדור, מה קרה פתאום? שכחתי את הכל, הם רוצים להשכיח.
So from the standpoint of the Rav Avadya Yosef's son, the whole approach of Rav Mazuz is to uproot the psakim of the Rav Avadya Yosef. Now, it's not true. It is not true. And in the Kisei Rachamim Yeshiva, that's the only yeshiva in the world where they study as a seder, the Abia Omer. And when all these other Rosh Yeshiva were attacking Rav Avadya Yosef, it was only in Kisei Rachamim that they supported him. And Rav Avadya Yosef was the president of Yeshiva Kisei Rachamim. However, it is true that Rav Mazuz does not accept all of Chacham Avadya's psakim, and he doesn't accept all of his views on political matters. Rabbi Mazuz never became was never on the Moetzes of Chachmei Torah of the Shas party, because he never agreed with the dovish positions of Rav Avadya Yosef. But he wouldn't disagree with him publicly, never. But he couldn't be on the Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah of the Shas party, because they give the rubber stamp to everything Chacham Avadya Yosef does. So the Shas party, for instance, abstained from Oslo. Rav Mazuz was very opposed to Oslo Accords. So he couldn't be on the Moetzet Chachmei HaTorah, but he never publicly opposed him. And he did not ever publicly oppose any psakim of Chacham Avadya Yosef. That's, I guess you could say, that's great respect. However, once Chacham Avadya Yosef was niftar, he doesn't feel that he needs to follow everything he says, and therefore he will give his psakim, and he's a right winger, he's a hawkish person, and this great being mevatel himself was only during his lifetime. So when Chacham Yitzchak Yosef says that they are trying to uproot the heritage, it's not true, but there is some truth to that, because why should the Tunisians and why should the Moroccans be bound to the psakim of Chacham Avadya Yosef forever? And when they speak about how in Kisei Rachamim, he hasn't been someone like him in hundreds of years, you can see that they'd be upset. It was a very bitter election. So after the election was lost by the Achad party, look, if I was in Israel, I don't think I'd vote for the Achad party, even though I consider him my rabbi of sorts, because politically it doesn't align with me, I don't think, a little too right wing. And I don't like the rabbis getting involved so much. But nevertheless, it was upsetting to see how bitter it became. They brought everything out in the kitchen sink. The Shas people took an old video of Rabbi Mazuz in which he attacks the Chabad Messianics, and they portrayed him as being opposed to all Chabadnikim. And they brought it to Kfar Chabad, so that they would not get any votes from the Lubavitchers. They brought up stuff that is liberal view of conversion to try to get. I mean, it was it's not good to see Balabatim, Askanim, trying to defame rabbis. But whatever, it happened. So I wrote him a letter saying how upset I was to see that so-called Orthodox Jews could fall to such a level where they engage in such behavior. Look, it's Rabbi Mazuz was naive, and a lot of people are naive. If you're going to, politics is a rough and tumble business. It's a dirty business. If you're not going to get in the gutter, then you shouldn't be there. You need to respond in kind. We know that negative advertising works. So I wrote him this, and then he writes back to me. This is in Tammuz of Tufshinai and Hay. Calls me Yedidinu Ha'akar. He says, I haven't had time to respond to you until now. He says, from the election until now, they continue to persecute us and everyone who's connected to us. They threw out students from yeshivos and people studying in Kollel who were working for Yachad. That's the way the Haredim work. They did it also against the Peleg group for Rabbi Auerbach. If you would work for a certain the other political party, they throw you out of their yeshivos. As if we're a reform group or a branch of Mapam. And despite this, on the other hand, he says, for Yair Lapid, they show him a good face and they invite him to various events. Gedola sina shasonim charedim et acharedim, misina shasonim chilonim et acharedim. He says that the hatred we've seen of the charedim for other charedim is worse than the hatred of the secularists for the Haredim. And we know that is the case. The battles, internal battles in the Haredi world, the way they fight with each other, it's worse than the way the secularists oppose the Haredim. There's no hatred like you have in the Haredi world, one to the other, unfortunately. But then he says it's not going to help them. He quotes a pasuk from Yehuda Halevi's poetry. So I think this is actually an important letter, because after the election, Rav Mazuz gave one speech that I know of. You can see it on the Yeshiva website, in which he spoke about all the things they did and how, despite that, we didn't go in the gutter with them. And we're very proud of the fact that we got 120,000 votes. I mean, 120,000 votes. Everyone said afterwards, oh, these are votes in the garbage, that these votes could have gone to one of the right-wing parties. But as far as I know, this is the only written document where he reflects on the loss. So one day when they write the history of the Achad party and Eli Yishai, I mean, he's finished his political career, although he served honorably. But they will use this letter, I believe. And together with what I sent him, I also sent him one of the ways Rabbi Mazuz was attacked, especially in the lead up to the election, is they argued that he has no respect for Gedolim. In other words, they had to tear down the leading figure, the spiritual leader. So they say they have these magazines that came out saying he has no respect for Gedolim, citing all the different things he said. And one of the things he said is that Rabbi Mazuz in many places has pointed out that the Rishonim wrote many of their writings, their books, from memory. How do we know that? Because they misquote Psukim. And there's plenty of examples of this. In my book, Studies in Maimonides' Interpreters, I have it here. No, I don't have a copy here. I give examples, many, many examples. And I actually think this is a positive thing. It shows how brilliant they were, the Rambam and others, that they knew everything by heart and they didn't copy it. They didn't bother looking. They just knew it by heart. So they make little mistakes sometimes. What's the alternative? You want to say that they had a different version of Chumash? Is that more respectful? We saw what Rav Chovanesky suggested that. But no, they were citing from memory. But they use this to show that Rabbi Mazuz doesn't respect Gadol Yisrael because he says that they make mistakes. And no, I mean, what else are you supposed to do? They're quoting a pasuk. It's incorrect, but they made a whole big thing. So he writes to me, thank you very much for sending me all the makorot, because I sent him many, many more. Idiyukim barishonim b'tzitzur pesukim. And then he says, even Moshe Rabbeinu says, shamati v'shachachti. If Moshe Rabbeinu can make a mistake and say he forgot something, all the more so that other Gedolim. So this is important. The idea that you're going to say that Rishonim never misquote Pesukim, if you say that, then you're left saying that they had different versions of Tanakh. And that's definitely not the case. We see that there's examples in Rashi. We see examples in the Rambam, where they obviously were quoting from memory. Sometimes it's a manuscript issue. And the misquote, like you saw with Yaakov Ravakov, is only in the manuscript. But other times we have their actual handwriting. And so they cited from memory, as Yosef Ibn Kaspi says. I cite this in my book. He says, you shouldn't be surprised by this. Do you think that every time this great rabbi wants to quote a pasuk, he's going to go look it up and find it? They cited it. Maybe they assume that the person who reads it will correct it if it's wrong. That's Siman Kuf Lamed Chet. This brings us to Siman Kuf Lamed Chet. And this goes back. This is one of the earliest letters, and I know why I wrote it, but I wasn't sure what the motivation was. I know what led up to it, I should say. We all know who Wagner is. Here, let me, the big anti-Semite, but the great composer. Yaakov Katz. Yaakov Katz wrote a whole book, The Darker Side of Genius, Richard Wagner's Anti-Semitism. Well, one of the issues that scholars look at is do you see the anti-Semitism coming out in his music or anything like that? There were many Jews who were fans, I guess you could say, of Wagner. Israel has never played Wagner, the symphony. They never played Wagner after the war because of the anti-Semitism, the connection, of course, the Holocaust. There's even a direct connection between Hitler and Wagner, in that Wagner's son-in-law was Houston Stewart Chamberlain, who he married the daughter of Wagner, and he, as it says here, has been referred to as Hitler's John the Baptist. Hitler was very much inspired by him, came to see him. So although Wagner was not what we would call a racial anti-Semite, that is, he hated Jews, but occasionally you could have a Jew that Wagner liked. But Wagner's music was raised during the Nazis to the heights of authority. And obviously Mendelssohn was degraded as Jewish music. I remember when Zubin Mehta, the conductor, I believe that he was the conductor for the Israel Philharmonic, they put together, they wanted to do Wagner, and people, they did it actually, and people got very angry. People sent back their season's tickets. Zubin Mehta, incidentally, as I recall, he's a Zoroastrian. There aren't that many of them left. That was the major religion in Babylonia in the days of Chazal. But as I recall, check it now. Zubin just occurred to me. Zubin Mehta, is he? He's directing a director emeritus. He's. I'm pretty positive that he's. If you look in. If I look at Zoroastrian famous people, let me just see quickly here. Zubin Mehta, yes, he comes up. Actually, you know, the other one comes up, who's even more famous, Freddie Mercury. Freddie Mercury was a Zoroastrian. If you don't know what Zoroastrian is, check it out. But they people got very upset. So at the time, Wagner was in the news. If you're a Jew, a good Jew, you're not religious. Religious Jews wouldn't do this. You wouldn't, for example, play this at your wedding. During the Nazi years, you couldn't, even if you wanted to. I would say if you're a good Jew, you shouldn't blame Mendelssohn either, although he converted as a child, so you don't want to blame him, but still, he's a mashumad. But so one, I think they play when they walk down the aisle. The other, they play when they go back. I guess it's Yachtus. You join together Wagner and the one he hated and despised, Mendelssohn. But so I was interested, what Rabbi Mazuz thought about Wagner. Not that I'm going to not listen to Wagner. I happen to like Wagner. Chacham Avadi Yosef, when he would listen to what he thought anti-Semitic Arab musicians, he'd listen and he'd say, yeah, like, feh, feh. But he listened to the music. But I wrote to him, and he writes back to me that... in general, the listening to music is problematic because the Churban, we allow listening to music from the radio, but so this Hateri, but he says, Neginos, the music of this Tamei, of Wagner, he says, Pshita u Pshita she'asur l'shaman, it's forbidden. I'm very interested to know what the Orthodox did in Germany. Maybe we have someone of long standing here from... German Orthodox community, Washington Heights, growing up, if you ever heard anything Wagner, because there are Jews who listen to Wagner, and their attitude was, the fact that he hates us, I still like his music. I don't know in the Orthodox world, we all know they went to the opera, did they go to the Wagner opera? Were they in that cult? Chaim Cohen, in his conversation with Michael Shashar, I think he mentions going to Wagner, if I recall. I'd be curious to know about that. But he says it's usher. Because of the Churban, and you don't give a heter, I guess, for an anti-Semite. Until, he says, listen to this, until God, punishes Germany for what the punishment they should receive. And then he says, "As yuchnesu amanginot hanar l'makom ha-kodesh." He says, then, once the Germany receives this punishment, then these tunes could return to a place of holiness. I'm not sure what that means. I think what it means is that the punishment when Germany, it's like a Kabbalistic thing. After Germany receives its punishment, which will serve as a sort of catharsis, I guess, or a cleansing of its evil elements, so only the holy aspect, namely the inspiration that you can be inspired from this music, will remain and then be admissible. But this sounds like something Rav Kook would say. I was shocked. And I think that's what it means. Then once they're punished, once Germany receives its due, then the songs will be permissible. Whatever that means. I think it has some Kabbalistic significance. I don't know. But let's leave it at there. And then we move to Siman Kuf Mem, page 294. this has a few things I'm not going to get into. One, I wrote to him about there was a man named David Kazis in, who wrote all these articles about rabbis of Tunisia. And I wanted to ask him, who's this David Kazis? And lo and behold, he says all sorts of bad things. He was the Menahel of the Allianz School in Tunis. So that caused all sorts of problems, led to terrible spiritual decline. So I didn't know that, but that's interesting. And then I asked him the question, as since he's so involved with Piyut and Shirei Sfarad, about the fact that we've mentioned it already, you have these poems written by great figures, medieval figures, that homoerotic poems dealing with homosexuality. How is it that medieval Spanish poets would write like this? And I'm not sure, no one's really sure what to make of it. I shouldn't say no one's really sure. A lot of people think, some people think it was just they're adopting a formula of that the Arabs used, like Shira Shirin. You'd be no difference if you write that. They write also poems about pretty young girls also. I should say pretty young women. But in those days, women was younger than it is today. So what to make of this? Listen, you can read all the scholarship on it, Scheindlin. But Rabbi Mazu says, Chas v'shalom, to think that any of the real Spanish poets were writing that. On the contrary, he cites then the work Tachamoni. There's 10 songs there cursing a certain evil one who did write like this. So he acknowledges that there at least was one person writing like this, but this is an evil one. But when you think in terms of the poets, the great poets, people like Moshe Ben Ezra and others, who are, I can't remember if he writes just about homoerotic stuff or just about women, but you have all these sorts of poems. He says that the Chokres Manenu hear from their own Hirurei Libam, they're writing about this. So then what do you do with these poems? He says that when they speak about the young Tzvichain, the young good-looking man, it's just a nice young man, the Aimbo Dofi, and there's no problem with it. But maybe yes, maybe no, I don't know. They do have poems, though, where they write about wine, they write about women, they write about men. There's all sorts of weird stuff going on. And I'm prepared to accept that this is just a genre. Just like Shira Shirim is a genre, you adopt that sort of language as a sort of side. That was how they wrote poetry. So I understand that today we never would write like that, but they were living in a different environment. And it's hard to imagine that poets living in an Orthodox society would publicly write about forbidden desires and things like that. It still was a community in which the rabbis had certain control with the community leaders. They didn't allow just hefkeros. I mean, they had problems, obviously. We know in Spain they had problems. They had all sorts of problems with men living with concubines and things like that. But to have people writing about it, it's an issue, though. I don't really know what to do if there's one answer that can solve all these problems. I think Raymond Scheinman, I think, assumes that these are real reflections of what people were thinking, which is fine about some figures you don't know. But when you have Shirei Chol of people like Ibn Gabirol and the Ibn Ezras and others, it's hard to know what to make of this. But that is just a short letter. We can't really go into it in detail because I don't really know enough about it. And I don't know what to make of it. And then I asked him a different question that... there was a huge issue in Bnei Brak about this, but others have written about it. A rabbi named from Yeshivas Kisei Rachamim, named Rabbi Moshe Levy, unfortunately died young. He wrote, he died in his early 40s, and he probably wrote like 15 books, important works. One of them is Menucha Avatz on the laws of Shabbos. And he discussed the issue. It's an old question. Can you kill lice on Shabbos? Normally, you don't kill insects, but the Gemara tells us, this is Masachas Shabbos, that you're allowed to kill lice on Shabbos. Why? Because only animals or only living beings that reproduce together, male female reproduction, is forbidden to be killed on Shabbos. But you can kill lice because lice don't reproduce. Lice, they come out of your sweat. they spontaneously generate, spontaneous generation. The Rambam, by the way, he also accepted spontaneous generation. He's writing in medieval times. So the question, therefore, is can you kill lice on Shabbos? Because now, today, we know that lice doesn't spontaneously reproduce. And you take a microscope and you can see lice eggs. So this question was raised by this Rabbi Levy, and B'nai Brak exploded with people saying, what type of heretic are you talking about this matter? And I asked Rabbi Mazuz, and he just points out that I sent him a number of books. I wanted to know, because there are people who say that it doesn't matter what Chazal determined to be the halacha, even if we have scientific information differently, we keep it. And others thought differently. Rabbi Mazuz even mentions, he says, I think this is the machokas in the Pachad Yitzchak of Lampranti. And he's right. This question is first raised in the 18th century. Rabbi Yitzchak Lampranti raises the question. Because now we could see that the lice are reproducing. Rabbi Yitzchak Lampranti thought that we should be machmir today. And in our own day, there have been people who've said that. As I recall, Rav Kafach says, we should not kill lice on Shabbos because now we see, and Chazal were not speaking to us from Nevuah or any Ruach HaKodesh or anything, even a tradition. They were just in line with the best scientists of their day. And now we see that it's incorrect, that even lice eggs reproduce, and therefore we shouldn't kill it. And that is a position held by Poskim. But the majority position is we don't change. And Yitzchak Lampranti, who wanted to be machmir, he sent his tshuva to his teacher, Rabbi Yehuda Briel. And Yehuda Briel says, no, we don't change the halacha. The issue of B'nai Brak was that they thought it was heresy to say that the sages might not have all the facts and might have made a decision incorrectly. Rabbi Dessler had a different approach. Rabbi Dessler said, and this also, I think, B'nai Brak, they might have a problem with it. He said that Chazal, we have a tradition that you can kill lice on Shabbos. The reason for it, however, did not come from tradition. The Chazal tried to come up with a reason, and therefore they gave this reason. But the law doesn't depend on the reason. They just are giving the reason what they were told by scientists. They didn't investigate. That's the assumption we're saying. They didn't investigate it. He said that they just gave a reason, but the reason doesn't bind us. So if you don't like that reason, it doesn't mean you change the halakha, because there's other reasons that we don't know about. The Gra also said that when the sages give reasons for things, don't assume that that's the only reason. There's other reasons. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, he has a whole letter explaining that the sages were not scientists. They went to the best scientists of their day, like we go to the best scientists. And if the best scientist of the day said something, then they accepted it. The problem, however, is, so Rabbi Mazuz doesn't think it's an issue at all. He says this is an old dispute, and he writes to the people who are attacking Rav Moshe Levy, if you're going to attack him, look back, what does the Gemara say about if anyone says King David sinned when he didn't, Hareza Toa, he's mistaken. You're not going to call people heretics. It's there's a lot of extremism there. But I just want to note that I found something which shows you that maybe everyone's wrong, and that Chazal did know. And maybe you don't need a microscope, because why do I say this? Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer. Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer is a late midrash from the 8th century, maybe 9th century. If you look at chapter 26, it says that when Avimelech, with Avram, Avimelech, we're told that all the, because when he took Sarah, everyone in his household, in the Kavos, the women, became barren. And what does it say? Here we see in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, which was recorded in the 9th century, 8th century, but it records traditions going back hundreds of years, that they recognize such a thing as eggs of lice. So the idea that they didn't know about it, we see they did know about it. Science made no real changes from the years 1 to the year 1000. Now, there's no real advances in the sense that significant advances. So if they knew something in the 8th century, then they knew it in the 4th century. So none of the tshuvot, as far as I know, that discuss this refer to the Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer. So I would go with Rabbi Dessler, I think, that not really Dessler, with others who explained that, yes, they knew that there were, lice had eggs, how they knew about it. Maybe you can see it even with the naked eye. I don't know. Or maybe they have a tradition. Who knows? But there's this notion which is put forth by some of the Acharonim that if you can't see it, it's as if it doesn't exist. Just like we know with the naked eye. So we can't see, I mean, one way we can't see, you can, if you can't see a bug, you can eat it. The question, only issue is that they have the big disputes about lettuce and everything, is if you can see it, but you can't see it move. You just see like a piece of dirt. Some say that's a problem. Others say it's not. We cannot see the two lice create the eggs. If you see the egg, that's not an issue. I mean, if something grows, you can see it. But we cannot see the lice join together and then create the next egg, the eggs. So if that's the case, it's not apparent to the human eye. Therefore, it has no significance. So when they say that any creatures that do not reproduce, male and female, it's not referring to reproduction that can't be seen. It's referring to like a dog and a cat and even maybe ants or something. So that seems to me to be the best way of dealing with this problem. That it's not the Chazal didn't know. If they didn't know, they didn't know, but that's not the issue. The issue is when they speak about lack of reproduction, they talk about that you can see. And that would solve the problem with the Pirkei de Rabbi Yosef. And that's the tshuva here. And then we get into the next tshuva. This is the last one we'll do tonight. Page 296, number 141. And this is a very long one. This, you have to first see my letter. I save up all my questions and I send them. So there's my questions and his answers. So it begins, I begin by saying that I don't need you to always reply to my letters because I don't want to cause bittul Torah. But if you look at what I write, then I'll feel good about that. And I'll skip the first thing I wrote about and I'll go to the second one. And this deals with, my letter deals with this individual. His name is Rabbi Moshe Kunitz of Offen. Offen is the German word for Buddha. Budapest used to be divided between Pest and Buddha was called Offen. He was the rabbi in Offen. And he wrote a number of books. He wrote responsa called Tsarev, there you see it there. It says here, and this is, they're selling this by auction, he was a controversial figure, as he was both a rabbi great in Torah knowledge, as well as an enlightenist, that's not an English word, fluent in secular studies. But that's not, they got it wrong here. That's not why he was controversial, really. He was controversial, by the way, he wrote it, this book also. This is a famous, most famous work. It's called the Ben Yochai. It's all about Rav Shim ben Yochai. It's a very important work because it shows you every example in halachic, in the Rishonim, in the Shulchan Aruch that can be traced to the Zohar. But it's also very important. Here's the cave that Rashbi was in. It's also important because he rejects Rav Yaakov Emden. Rav Yaakov Emden argued that the Zohar is medieval, it's late, even though it preserves, he thought it was a holy work, it preserves certain traditions. But the Zohar, as we have it, he thinks is a complete medieval work with sections that I guess would be ancient in it. And this is a rejection of it. And he goes through page after page. His the Chasam Sofer said he'd rather have what Yaakov Emden said than what he said, because his replies are just, most of them are completely bogus. A few of them are good, but... The very first one is the famous one. The Zohar refers to Esnoga, as Beit Knesset. And this, what's Esnoga? It's clearly the word synagogue, from the word synagogue that we know it. So he tries to come up with some crazy etymology. No one really takes that work of Rav Moshe Kunitz seriously, although his tshuvot are quite interesting, and his tshuvot are important because he preserves one of the only halachic writings of Rav Nosson Adler. In fact, it might be the only halachic letter of Rav Nosson Adler is in there. And you have letters in there from the Big Gedolim as well as from some Haskalah figures, Rav Moshe Kunitz. If you go to Budapest today, you go to the cemetery, Rav Moshe Kunitz is buried in the row of the rabbis because he was the Rav of Offen. He was one of the Gedolim of Budapest. What happened was that He's right next to a person named Rav Shimon Oppenheim. People have never heard of Shimon Oppenheim, but I take my groups there. We'll go back, God willing, again. And I always tell them that the Hasidim come to this grave of Shimon Oppenheim, which is two over from, as I recall, from Rav Moshe Kunitz. And every time we're there, there's never any Hasidim. Baruch Hashem, the last time we went, we're there, and a whole group of Hasidim come. Why did the Hasidim come? Because this Rav Shimon Oppenheim was a Hasid. But he has on his tombstone, in fact, I think some people listening to us now even came with us. We're on that trip, the last Central Europe trip. On the tombstone, it says, whoever comes here and recites a certain prayer, what's the prayer? I forgot. From Mavar Yabaka. It's just like a Yisker type of prayer. I will intercede with you in heaven. So this is very unusual. Here you have a guarantee that if you come to the Kever and you recite this prayer, he's going to intercede with you. So I guess it can't hurt. But this is, the Hasidim go through Europe. They go to the different graves. They do. We go to different sites, and we go to some graves. But they go, it's amazing. I found these Hasidim, and they're in the big cities. They don't even bother going to the sites. They just go to the Kvarim, and this is one of the Kvarim on the stops. They'll go here, and then from here, they'll go to Rabbi Shaya of Karastir, and they'll do all the different graves. And they come there because he says he'll intercede. So Rav Moshe Kunitz is there. In the 19th century, early 19th century, the reformers, they wanted some halachic justification. There was one generation where the reformers wanted halachic backing for their ideas. And then they just became complete reformers. And one of the things they wanted halachic backing for was to play music in a shul. And they wrote to Italy, because in Italy they had music. In Italy they actually used music, like organs in the shul by a non-Jew. But they also wrote to Rav Moshe Kunitz. There's a reason they didn't ask the rabbis in Germany, because the rabbis in Germany knew what type of people these were. They just were looking for heterim. But they wrote to Rav Moshe Kunitz, and Rav Moshe Kunitz, he wrote an answer. He just went through the halachic sources. He says, well, if a non-Jew is playing it, what's the problem? It's a shus to shus, as we say, being called mitzvah. It's a rabbinic prohibition. In other words, and playing an instrument in the first place is rabbinic, and having a non-Jew play it is a double remove. So we know that's permissible. Non-Jews play instruments on Friday night at a wedding. We have non-Jews light the candles in the shul. So he just looked at it from pure halachic and says, if it's positive, then you can do it. Well, when this was published, he was, no one attacked him in his lifetime as a reformer, and everyone still considered him just a rabbi who was led astray by the reformers who got him in their grip. By the 20th century, he was regarded as a reformist, which is not true. He's an open-minded rabbi, but he's not a reformist at all. He's a regular Rav. He's a Dayan. He's buried with he lived and died the Dayan in Buda, and actually later he moved to Pesht. And you see where he's buried, and he was always regarded as a liberal rabbi, but an authentic rabbi. So much so that his reputation took a turn for the worse, and I say this all in my letter to Rabbi Mazuz, that they removed, if you look in the old Vilna Mishnayos, not the new printed one, the ones we all have with the Tosfos Yom Tov and the Bartanura, at the first volume, right at the beginning of it, you have the biography. He wrote like a biography in a play of Yudha Nasi. And they take part of it. They don't do the whole thing, but they include part of his, as I recall, first he has the biography and then he has like a whole play, but the biography, they include it. It's in your Vilna Mishnayos on your bookcases. If you have it, Rav Moshe Kunitz, the biography. They took it all out because he's a reformer. And I'm writing all this story of Mazuz because he cites Rabbi Moshe Kunitz, and growing up in Tunis, they would learn his Sfarim. And the last thing I mention is something I say to Rabbi Mazuz, and I began with a quiz question. I'll ask you another question and we'll end. So I write to Rabbi Mazuz. I say, if the censors really wanted to, if these people who took out Rav Moshe Kunitz's commentary, who know nothing about Rav Moshe Kunitz, but if they really wanted to be the censors, then there's something else they could take out. And I said to Rabbi Mazuz, and you yourself called attention to this, right after Rav Moshe Kunitz's, I think it's right after, not right before. No, right after Rav Moshe Kunitz's biography. someone is someone sound us on. Right after Rav Moshe Kunitz's biography of Rav Yehuda Nasi, there is a grammar. Because everyone just check. I hear someone sound. If someone's sound is on, just turn off. I hear there's a grammar of Mishneiot Hebrew. And let me show you this. And this will be the last thing we see today. And we'll see who can figure it out, what I'm going to show you. So in this grammar, it's by a maskil of in Vilna or around there, called Shlomo Levinson. It's called Maimar al Dikta Goshen Mishnah. And you have it in all your texts. In the second column over here, he talks about how in the Mishnah, you see already usages of Aramaic. What do I mean, usages of Aramaic? Well, they use Aramaic words, putting it into Hebrew. So for instance, the word Beit Tefillah, house of prayer, in Aramaic, it's called Beit Knista, and then that comes back into Hebrew as Beit Knesset. That's what he's saying. And he gives a number of examples of where words in Aramaic are brought back into Hebrew through the Aramaic. The word matzoi is because of the word shchiach. And then he gives this example right here. He says, also say the word levad. In biblical Hebrew, you'd have the word, instead you say in the Mishnah, you have the word chutz instead of levad. Why not levad alone? You know, this person, you would say this person, not those people, he said, alone from those people, you do use the word levad. And that would be the biblical word. But instead of that, they use the word chutz. Now, why do they use the word chutz? He says, because in Aramaic, you have the word bar. The word bar means outside, but it also means separated from. So for example, the word, when you take it back into Hebrew, bar means outside, that means chutz, but it also means like separated, not just outside, like living outside your house. Chutz me'abayit, I mean, you also say mi'chutz l'machaneh, so separated from everyone else. So again, the word chutz is not a biblical Hebrew word. But the word bar in Aramaic, he's saying, refers to outside. So then it becomes in Hebrew, both usages. Outside, let's say outside a house, but also outside, you know, outside of us, our group. And then he said, so in the note, look in the note. And this is, let's see if you can figure it out. He says, remember that the word chutz is not a biblical Hebrew word. He says, vim sasham pamachat, you'll find it one time in the book of Koheles. And he cites the verse here in Koheles. Here's the verse. He cites it chapter 3. It's really chapter 2. It's a mistake here. Let's see. Where is it? I got to search quickly here. Where is it? Hold on. I didn't write it down. Yes, here in verse 25. Take a look. What does the verse say? Ki mi yochal umi yachush. For who will eat or who will enjoy chutz mimeni, apart from me? So here you have the word used in biblical Hebrew, chutz meaning levad. So let's go back to what he says now. Where is he? So he says, you'll find it one time in the Bible, in this pasuk, chutz mimeni. Then he says, v'yimtzu od b'sefer hazeh. You'll find other places in this book, harbei darchei hadibur, many other examples of forms of language, ashahema kafi tchunat lashon harami, that are in line with this principle we're talking about, Aramaic back into Hebrew, v'hatam yadua maskileyam. And he says the reason for this is known to the people who are maskileyam, the intelligent. Okay, class. What is he referring to? What does he mean? What is the Tam Yadua? The Maskilayam. That you'll find in Koheles, these Aramaic forms back into Hebrew. Who's going to tell us? Tam Yadua, the Maskilayam. What he's hinting to, but not saying explicitly, is that this is the proof that Kohelis is a later work, not written by Shlomo HaMelech, because Shlomo HaMelech wouldn't use these Aramaic terms. So he says that the word chutz is not found at all in Tanakh, except in Kohelis, and you also find other examples where these Aramaic forms are put back into Hebrew. And the reason for that is, no, he doesn't want to spell it out, but those who know understand, namely that Kohelis is really not Solomonic, but is a much later work when they already did Aramaic. Now, Rabbi Mazuz was the one who pointed it out, but if so, I said to him, if the censors understood this, that's what they should censor. But that's in every one of your Mishnayoses, and yet Moshe Kunitz is very kosher. Nice biography of Rav Yehuda Anasi, that's been removed, but this semi-kfira still remains there. So we'll end with that. We're in the middle of my letter, and as I said, next class we'll deal with Kalman Shulman Namaski, we'll deal with Gilgal and what the Rishash, Rav Shmuel Strashun, has to write about it. More good stuff, and if we... next week also will be devoted to Rabbi Mazuz, a number of interesting stuff, and then we'll turn to some new figures, and wait till you get to Rav Herschel Schechter. We're coming to some great stuff from him as well. So let me take the questions and comments. We've gone over time a bit. Let's see. Susanna says the Haskalah changed Ashkenazic attitudes towards grammar, if I'm not mistaken. You're absolutely correct. They even gave the example. They said that we used to be able to offer a sacrifice on a bama, but when the... Now we can't. Same thing with Haskalah. We said when the Haskalah used to be kosher, when the Maskilim started doing it, it's non-kosher. But today there's no more Maskilim. So then no one's doing that. The Maskilim were saying, you don't need to learn Gemara. It's better to learn Tanakh and Diktuk. This is just Diktuk. The Ashkenazim stopped learning Tanakh. Hirsch, in the 19 letters, he attacks this idea, which he calls misguided, that you shouldn't have to learn Tanakh anymore. But this, it became popular that we don't need to do that. But today, these people don't exist anymore. So we should, therefore, in the Ashkenazic world even, you have a return to TikTok and things like that. Rabbi Kelman says, the attitude to speaking Hebrew, Zionim, studying Tanakh. This was all because of the Haskalah. Baruch meant the common pronunciation of Sheker and MS are wrong, should be switched. Shkoyach to Baruch. David says, the boxer turned entrepreneur. Actually, Rafael Halperin wasn't a boxer, he was a wrestler. Although if you read all the essays on him, it says he didn't want to do fake wrestling, even though this is all fake wrestling. He would actually do what he wanted to do, even if he's supposed to take a dive, he didn't care. And he came to America, it was all fake, but he refused to go along with it. So apparently with him, it was half real, half fake. I didn't say Sheker, not Sheker, Emmet. Well, you ask, what about the rule of, a good question, of Segolio? So now I have my dictionary here, because it's easier to look up this and show you. Do I have my sitter here? Emes Leamuna. Yeah. I have a prayer book here. I got the Machzor here, the Birnbaum Machzor. So let me look in Myriv on Rosh Hashanah. If you look at Emes, this is to, who is it writing? I don't even need to look. I should look down. Susanna pointed it out. It has a chataf segel, not a segel. So there you go. A chataf segol is really a shiva. So I'm sorry, Susanna, for not reading the next thing. I wonder if I have to pull it off my chaff. So it's not a sheker, it is. You can't say sheker. Sheker is like any other word, dego. They all have it's all mila el. But emet, it's emet, because it's not a segol. So there you go. Barry says, my mother, Olav Shalom, told me how she met... father, young Israel dances. I met one person in particular who told me that, and many others told me about people they know. That was the era. I don't want to say it. People, Ramaz graduates will be upset. Ramaz actually had, you see this in Jeffrey Gurok's book on Ramaz, they had classes into the 50s, as far as I know, maybe even later, social dancing classes. You would learn the foxtrot there. They actually had these classes. And Rabbi Lookstein, you said, told us somewhere he did actions to bring Jews back to Yiddishkeit. Yeah, that's what they did in Ramaz. Baruch says, the Chacham Avadia held all Sfaradim should follow Rav Yosef Karo. Well, yes, we've spoken about this. We've dealt with it. And that's exactly Rav Mazuz's point. He doesn't think you need to follow Rav Yosef Karo, if you have a tradition in Tunisia. Although in one area, he went along with Rav Vadia because he doesn't think it's such an important thing. And that's with standing up for Aseres HaDibros. In Tunisia and in Morocco, they all stood up for Aseres HaDibros. So Mazuz says, now that we're in Israel, we can go along with this. It's not really a minhag that we have to stick with. But others, you're right. Baruch says, the general phenomenon, the closer you are, the need to distinguish oneself. There's differences. In the modern Orthodox world, there's fighting between YU and YCT, and that, it was greater than between Haredim and YCT. That is also true. The centrist attacks on YCT, because they feel threatened, because it's their territory, was harsher than the Haredi attacks. Exactly, that is true. And Susanna says, you think that the Israel Philharmonic is reconsidering a decision not to play Wagner's music. They did play Wagner. I remember they did play Wagner in Israel once. You can look it up, and it caused a huge a controversy over that. He was an anti-Semite, but that's not why they're not playing him. They're not playing him because of his connection to Nazi Germany, that he was the musician laureate, I guess you could say, and he was symbolic of Nazi Germany. That's the reason. There's plenty of other composers who were anti-Semites. That's not... David says, as a proof text for Mazuz's assertion that the hatred of Haredim to the Haredim is greater than hatred of the secular towards the Haredim, is the Gemara in Pesachim 49b. The hatred of a Torah scholar who abandoned Torah towards Torah scholars is worse than that of the Amei Haaretz. I don't know, David, if you're looking in the book, in the Sefer itself, I cite this in the note. Rabbi Mazuz himself cites this explicitly in another place. But you're right. That's a good point. That the hatred of the Torah scholar there who abandoned Torah. Daniel says in December 1991, the Israeli Philharmonic voted to play Wagner. I don't know. Actually, you're right. Take that back. What I said, Daniel. I think they voted to do it, but they never did. That's what it is. And because people were starting sending back their season tickets, it was right around then in 1991 that I wrote. It was such a big controversy, and I wrote to him about that. David says that one of Rav Kunitz's chuvas was that Moel, who does not have medical training, may not perform Brit Milah, and he actually cites a Rashi that says it's better to have medical training on it. But that's an article came out about 10 years ago or 15 years ago where a guy attacking Ramosha Kunitz, like some reformer, and he cites that and he cites other things. Ramosha Kunitz was simply like a modern Orthodox type of rabbi. He was, it would be better if a Moel was also a doctor. They don't have to be, but if they are, that's even better. Ah, so then Michael says, what about Pink Floyd's music, given Roger Walter's rabid anti-Semitism? Question is, would Rav Mazuz even acknowledge that you can, at the end of days, can you get something good out of it? I don't know. Classical music has a separate place. The Vilna Gaon said that music is a chokhmah. It's one of the chokhmahs. We know, Levi, tribe of Levi, we speak about the creation of music in Parshas Bereishis, but they're not referring to... modern Pink Floyd type of music. We're talking about, great music, I think. David says, Chutz appears at least three times in the Chumash, Shleto and other Nevi'im. But in that way, in that exact same form, in place of Levad, it has to be used in place of Levad, David. That's what we're talking about. Not, let's say, outside in the sense... separated from Levad alone, that sort of thing. And let me point out one thing. I can't get rid of my gears of the Yonkusa. I grew up always saying Samson Raphael Hirsch and Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, because after all, the name is Shimshon. But the truth is, and I heard this years ago, and it never really stuck with me, but I recently heard it again by the authority that Rabbi Hamburger, it was passed on to me by one of our listeners, his name really isn't Shimshon. Even though in Israel today he's called Shimshon. His name is Shamshon. That's how he was called up to the Torah. Now you're going to say, well, Shamshon isn't a name. It's not a Hebrew name. It's a Hebraic type of name. But we have all sorts of names that are Wolf. People call up to the Torah Zev Wolf. Wolf isn't a name either. And we have these names that are Maimon, The Rambam's father's name is Maimon. Maimon is not a Hebrew word, but that's his name, and that's what he was called up to the Torah. They didn't have, so Rav Shimshon Rafa Hirsch's name is Shamshon. So from now on, if I can remember, I'll say Rav Shamshon Rafa Hirsch. It's not just that in German he's saying it, that's what they gave him. Now, why they gave him, we haven't yet been able to determine why it became that, other than that's just what it became in Germany. Germany had some interesting names. So David says Wagner was played in Tel Aviv in 1981 and a Holocaust survivor stormed the stage. But I was not, that wasn't what I was referring to. That's before my time. Okay, and David says that no, when chutz is used earlier, I wasn't clear. When I said, I don't think I was clear. I was making it seem like chutz never appears. What I meant to say, it does, never appears as I'll show you just, and this will be the last thing, as levad. Here it is. You can check it out later. Tachas milas levad chutz. And then he goes on to explain that whole thing. So the only place we find it is in Koheles. So thank you all, and please correct me if I say it again, Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch is Shamshin. In Germany, they would call him, even the rabbis referred to him as Hirsch. They didn't feel that you need to call him Rav Hirsch.
His name wasn't Raphael Hirsch either. That was his father's name. As you, when we go to the Kever in Frankfurt, Shimshon Ben Raphael Hirsch's last name was Hamburger. That's what I thought you were going to say. His name was actually Hamburger, Shamshon, whatever, Hamburger.
I don't know if you ever used that name.
If you remember, on the Kever, it's Shimshon, a Frankfurter? I thought it was Hamburger. No, I think it's Hamburger.
I don't think he ever used that name, though.
No, but on the Kever, it says Shimshon Ben Raphael Hirsch Hamburger. In other words, Hirsch was his father. He wasn't Raphael Hirsch. That was his father. And that's also the only grave, if I'm sure you remember, the only grave I've ever seen in my life that has at the bottom, Taf Nun Sadiq. No.
Let me show him.
Nun Sadiq Beit Hei.
There you go.
Show us Kever.
There it is. Rabbi Shamshon Ben Marin Rav Raphael Hirsch, Frankfurt, the Av Basin, and what were you referring to, Rabbi Kelman?
Okay, so look at the bottom. It's Nun Sadiq Beit Hei. There's no Taf. Nafshot Shurah B'Tzura Chaim. There's no Tehei.
Yeah, his wife has it.
There was no doubt that Shimshon Raphael Hirsch was going to Gan Eden. So they didn't have to write Tehei. That's for normal people. But Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, Nishmatot Shurah. I remember when we were there together on our first trip ever. Not our first trip, but our trip to, our Germany trip, that's where we were. And it's pretty mind-boggling. But his wife is next to him. I seem to remember Hamburger. So why am I getting that wrong? But it's Shimshon Ben Raphael Hirsch.
Yeah.
But anyways.
Okay, thank you all. Final words from Rabbi Kelman.
Those were pretty much the final words. Okay, tomorrow. I mean, that's just to discuss. Listen, my uncle was also Wolf. Zev Wolf, that's my uncle Zev, who you know very well. We called him Wolf. His name was Velvel. But talking about that other name too. But that's fascinating with Raphael Hirsch. Anyways, okay. Okay, thank you very much. Tomorrow morning, like I said right at the beginning, Benny Gesundheit at 12:15, our regular shiur at Tehillim. And that is followed at 1:30 by Yosef Rubel kicking off a five-part series on Shir HaShirim. Okay.
I think what you're thinking of, because the reason you thought that is because he was born in Hamburg. Although
I know, but
he has a grandfather named Frankfurter.
Yeah.
But that's,
I thought that was on the Kever, but I guess I was wrong. That's what I thought. I remember the Nishmatot Tzvura without the Tehei. And of course, that it's his
father. Oh, wait, hold on. Baruch's correctly pointing out something. I made a mistake on the Kever itself.
Back to the Kever and blow it up and see what it looks like again.
Yeah, no, it's that's I was wrong in what I said. It's not here. I'll pull it up for you again. Hold on a second. I'm pulling it up. Where are we here? There we go. It's not. It's Pei there stands for Frankfurter. That's his grandfather's name.
Where does it say Frankfurter?
Pei. It doesn't mean Frankfurt, even though he was rabbi in Frankfurt. They're attaching his name to him. But he never wrote it by that name, but he never wrote anything, but that was his grandfather's name. I don't even know if his father used the name Pepe. See, after Hirsch, it says Pepe.
Go down a little bit. I just want to see the rest of it.
That's what it refers to as Frankfurter.
Although that's very, and it says, I remember he died on a Friday, I think, on December 31st, if I'm not mistaken, 1888. It says when he died, he was buried on the Sunday. Is that there? Yeah. No. Uvala Beit Moed, Lemachra.
He died.
So maybe that's his wife next door.
The next day, he's buried Gimel.
Right.
So thank you, Baruch, for that. That it's a, you're right. They're putting Frankfurter, but I don't know. As far as I know, maybe our Washington Heights person can help us. I don't think he ever wrote, called himself that. And I don't know if his father ever did, but that was his grandfather's name. Yeah. Okay. Sorry for that. Thank you. Okay. Anything else, Rabbi? Any final words? Or that's it.
Thank you. Look forward to seeing you next week, please God. And, all right, everybody. I think there's snowstorms all over we're expecting. So keep people inside.